Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 37. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Bobby the Blitz Ellsworth, frontman for legendary thrash metal act Overkill. Overkill ranks highly on the list of thrash metal shows that were essential to my formative years as a teenage thrasher. I saw Overkill open for Motorhead and Slayer back in 1988. Slayer was touring South of Heaven, and I've been a fan even longer. From classic records like Taking Over and Field of Fire, to the badass music video for Hello from the Gutter, to this current string of killer releases the band has been putting out, The Electric Age, White Devil Armory, The Grinding Wheel, and the most recent album, The Wings of War, all of which have been released just in the last few years. I was stoked to talk to Bobby about Metallica and the formative years of thrash metal. And just before we get into the episode, I want to send out the biggest of well wishes to Metallica co-founder, Megadeth frontman, and thrash metal architect, Dave Mustaine, who on June 17th, 2019, announced to the world that he is battling throat cancer. His doctors are giving him a 90% chance of recovery, and myself and everyone involved with Pop Curse and Speak and Destroy is keeping him in our prayers. It's worth noting that both previous Speak and Destroy guest Chuck Billy of Testament and Bobby the Blitz Ellsworth, the guy you're about to listen to, have beaten cancer. So that's two iconic thrash metal singers who were diagnosed with the big C and beat it. Mustaine certainly won't be far behind. Dave, a lot of people are rooting for you. Many people around the world love you and wish you nothing but the best. So here it is, my conversation with Bobby the Blitz Ellsworth of Overkill. This is Speak and Destroy. I like to start these by going all the way back, and, you know, obviously I know a bit about you, so I know that, you know, Queen, Sabbath, Priest, Maiden, all that stuff was important to you, but I believe Alice Cooper was your kickoff, if I'm not mistaken. Tell me a little bit about, you know, falling in love with music and how it, where that came from, and, you know, did you have family members that were playing stuff around the house, or how did you first get inspired?
You know, I think it's with regard to me singing or falling into that, as we were just talking about heritage, my mother is one of 13 first-generation Americans. My grandparents are from the Emerald Isle. So when you have nine sisters, you understand harmony. And I think that, you know, my grandparents would sit around the fireplace and ask all the their daughters to get up and sing the old Irish lullabies. And so for me, it was always something really just taken for granted that it was always there. Now, obviously, I don't have this beautiful Irish tenor's voice, but I never had a fear of standing in front of people and singing. It was just natural in my family. And my mom actually cut a couple of records. She had done some, she was kind of on the local scene in New Jersey. She was out of Bayonne. But sang at the Copa with Tommy Dorsey and a guy named Dennis Day. Yeah, you know, she was brought in as one of the local talents. They would do that from city to city, places bringing somebody that was kind of a local mid-level star. But she cut a couple of records back in the 50s. So for me, you know, it was there already. I remember her voice singing to me prior to her talking to me. So it was just something natural that I grew up with. But, you know, acclimated to the rock and roll and the dirty side, you know, as soon as I could get down to, whatever the equivalent of Walmart was then, I guess Kmart or Caldors or something like that, and buy records that, even if I had to hide them under the bed, I would have them. thus Alice Cooper.
Right. Yeah, I grew up in Indiana, so I think we had Zayers, was a department store that had records, and then yeah, of course Sears and JCPenney and somewhere. We'd go find that, you know, looking for Kiss records and that otherwise wasteland of a place.
Yeah, sure. But you got to find, you know, you'll find somewhere to feed your habit, you know. And if it was riding the 10 speed down there, the Stingray, just so you can thumb through the records, it was that was a good day.
Right. So yeah. So how did that that first Alice record get in your hands? Was it something you sought out because of the album cover, or, you know, how did that come across your radar?
It was the album cover, you know, matched up with one of the probably the visuals from one of the early rock magazines. I mean, it could have been Hit Parader or something that preceded that. You know, just to see pictures of Alice Cooper and what his PR was all about. It wasn't just a picture of the band. There'd always be something that was absolutely bizarre. And I think anybody who, you know, had the cojones to put out a song called Dead Babies, you know, when I was like 14. I'm like, all right, I'm interested. He got my attention.
and who would have thought that he'd grow up to be a nice Christian man playing golf?
I mean, it's unbelievable. It's almost like Alice and Auntie Alice. You know, it's the Auntie Alice and Alice. But it's you know, I think he's one of the long-standing good guys in the industry.
Absolutely.
And one of the closest I've ever got to him was just a quick hello. We were, and it was just recently, we were playing Loud Park in Japan, and it's a fantastic festival. And he was on right after us, and I was coming off the stage sweating with no shirt on and walking down the corridor to the dressing room, and he came out in this, like, crushed velvet, you know, smoking jacket or waistcoat, rather, heading to the stage, taps me on the shoulder and goes, "Good set, kid." And I was thinking to myself, "Kid, fuck yeah."
Yeah, exactly. Take it.
Well, he was obviously watching it on the closed circuit in the dressing room, and I was. It's actually one of my prouder moments later on in the history of this band. And Alice Cooper actually got to watch a set of Overkill after I was into him since I was, you know, 14 years old.
Hell yeah! And then yeah, there, you know, let's talk a little bit about some of the other early stuff for you, you know, the Queen and Sabbath and Priest and Maiden, and I believe the Ramones were in there somewhere for you.
Oh, sure. The Ramones were ours, man. I mean, you could go Ramones spotting in on St. Mark's Place. I mean, when that punk scene exploded, I remember being, you know, of the age to get a short line bus into New York City to a place called the Port Authority. It's about an hour. And then a subway down to the Village, and that's the place to hang out when you're 16, 17, 18, even in your 20s. And, you know, you could see the Ramones over on St. Mark's Place around a clothing store called Trash in Vaudeville or where the Mud Club was. And, but there was all sorts of stuff going on down there. There was, you know, Iggy Pop was in town, you know, during that era. The Dead Boys had moved here soon after from Cleveland. So it was an awesome, awesome punk scene. It's something to be, you know, I think back and say, you know, one of the reasons that the band I'm in exists is because that punk scene, you know, infused that generation of us with that energy.
Yeah, you know, I had Michael Lago on the podcast a while back, and yeah, he got his start doing a Dead Boys fanzine, like, and I think maybe ran a fan club for them or something. And yeah, we talked a lot about that era and that. I mean, it's amazing the fact that you could throw a stone and hit somebody from the Ramones or the Dead Boys. You know, once upon a time is just a unique thing that clearly isn't going to happen again in that quite the same way.
Johnny Thunders out on 8th Street,
yeah.
Holding his boots from the New York Dolls.
I mean, yeah.
It's like, holy shit. It was like living in some kind of a psychotic, drug hazed dream. And it's, you know, it was just such a cool scene to be a youngster in. I mean, it was one of the reasons when I went to school after high school, I went to Manhattan College, because it was right on the One Line and I could get downtown, you know, real quick, or down to the Village, to see gigs or to, you know, feel like I was part of that. But that, you know, my choice of going into, the city to college was based a lot on the music scene.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And it's like, I also think about that era, you know, once upon a time, you could have seen Sid Vicious out on bail doing like a solo residency somewhere, like, you know, slopping his way through, like, you know, some 50 standards.
Right. Spitting at the audience and cursing at them, playing it out of tune, but everybody loving it.
Exactly. So at some point, obviously when we sort of connect the dots with Overkill and Metallica, aside from both being massively influential bands in terms of the thrash movement and just metal in America in general, there are also some crossover where, you know, you both were part of Megaforce at one point. Overkill was one of the elite bands that had a major label deal in the 80s, coming out of that scene. Where did you first sort of intersect and cross paths? You know, when did Metallica get on your radar and you became familiar?
We actually, they had been signed prior to us. They had, the demos, Metal Up Your Ass, No Life, were out. And I think that's when we became aware of them. That was, the tape trading days.
Yeah.
You'd pick up those fanzines and you'd find, where to send away for something. And a couple of the guys in the band, like Rat and Didi, were very into that whole scene. I mean, they knew everybody. I mean, this was not the age of instant information. It was, these were Xeroxed fanzines that, would be sent to them via the mail. And that's how we got our hands on demos. But after they released Kill 'Em All, they had come east to do some gigs. And there was a place here. It's up where the three states meet, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. It's a city called Port Jervis. And there was a guy we'd worked with up there at a place called the State Theater. And he put us in the opening slot for Metallica. So I think that's our first handshake with them at that time. We had opened that show for them, and we were an unsigned band, and they had obviously already released their first record.
And then do you remember, by the way, you mentioned that fanzine network and tape trading. A buddy of mine likes to call that secret knowledge, the world where you couldn't just become an instant expert on everything. You had to, if you were into something, you had to find some like-minded people and discover, this like underground network of information that's being passed back and forth. Do you remember kind of, hearing them for the first time or going to see them for the first time?
Well, hearing them, I heard them in Staten Island, New York, at where we rehearsed at Bobby Gustafson's house. We were in the basement. I think Rat actually brought Rat or Dee Dee brought their first demo in, and that's when we threw it in the cassette player, the boom box, and listened to it. And it was obviously groundbreaking. I mean, for us to think, obviously we weren't doing what they were doing. I think it was, we were just, let's say, cousins with regard to what our approaches were, but not identical. But I think that it was undeniable that it was special right away, that somebody actually had started the template for what was to follow. And I think it was obvious to all four of us who heard it in the room that first night.
That's interesting because, in terms of the creation of a musical movement or a subgenre or something like that. I mean, certainly there were a handful of you who were operating with the same basic ingredients, whether it's new wave or British heavy metal and punk and things like that, and sort of hitting upon something similar, but each with your own kind of unique flavor to it. And I always find that fascinating, like looking back with different movements in music, across genres where you can have people separated sometimes by an ocean, sometimes by, on different coasts that independently of one another are developing something special. And then, I imagine it's a lightning bolt moment when you're like, oh, these guys are doing something very similar to what we're doing. And we're all kind of hitting on this unique thing right around the same time.
I think it's representative of the era. And that's what gives it its purity, makes it very real that, in San Francisco, in New York, in Los Angeles, in Essen, Germany at that time, somewhere in the UK, that there was such a similarity when there was no instant information. It was when the world was still a really big place where you had to, you wanted to connect with people, you had to do it via the telephone or snail mail, or fly there. But it wasn't about getting a 400 likes a day on, for your demo. I mean, You want to fucking like somebody go, you know, you shake their hand and they say, man, I got the demo, I got Power in Black, or, you know, if it was a Metallica fan, I got the, you know, I got No Life to Leather. That's fucking great. There's your like, you know, when it's face to face. So I think it was really unique that it represented that era with such similarity while that template was being created in different places around the world.
I think that's something that, you know, people listening to this, who might be a generation or two behind us, you know, it's something that's a little bit lost now is how important those demos were. Like you said, you know, the Overkill demos and the Metallica and Megadeth and, you know, a lot of bands in that demo era where, sometimes those tapes, I mean, for fans anyway, they were like albums. You know, you thought of it as, you know, No Life to Leather was like the first Metallica album to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how that's kind of a lost art, because one of the things that I think was so important about that demo phase was an opportunity bands had to really develop a sound and an identity over the course of playing a lot of shows and doing regional touring and making demos, you know, to where by the time you were in the studio making your debut album, you had a much more definitive sense of what you're doing. You know, I think that's something that's a little bit lost now, where, you know, sometimes bands are making a record before they've even played a show.
It's a unique concept, you know, that you bring up, and it really does separate the old from the new school. And the demos, you know, were part of that, what'd you call it before? A world of secret information, or
yeah, the
network of
secret knowledge. Yeah.
Secret knowledge. I mean, it's like if you had a demo, from, you know, you had the Anthrax demo, or if you had the Metallica or Slayer, tapes that had been released, you were special, you know, I mean, and that's where, in my opinion, sure, the records that followed define their career, but that's where the lightning in the bottle was captured. Even if it wasn't recorded well or the songwriting was not of a higher caliber yet, it still was lightning in a bottle with regard to energy and direction. So you knew that this was the beginning of something big, or not in some cases, where you'd go, no, this one just doesn't have it. But if it had it on that demo, it was, and you were there at the beginning, then you were one of the chosen few.
Yeah, and I remember also as somebody who, you know, and I still do this today. If I discover a film director or something that I'm really inspired by, I'll want to go back and watch the early stuff. And even if you can find like a student film or a short or something that they did, you know, I love kind of unpacking it and reverse engineering it. And that was something I did with bands back in the day too. Feel the Fire and Taking Over, like I already had those records by the time I got Power in Black, but it was again part of that like secret knowledge where it's like I want to go back, you know, I want to find the demos, I want to like, you know, get somebody to dub me a copy of that and like, you know, to go back and sort of retrace the steps, so to speak. I always thought was exciting, and you know, and I think the thrash bands in particular were bands that were always very transparent about that and almost giving fans kind of a how-to guide of like how to build a band, you know. I think that was,
well, you know,
very cool.
That's the point is that thrash bands were fans of it as it was being created. It wasn't, we weren't over and above or next to. We were part of the, you know, the entire community as that community was growing. I mean, we might have been the ones creating it, but we were fans of what we were creating. So I think it was really easy to give those secrets away, or to share them with others in that through that that secret knowledge.
So when did you first have occasion to meet the guys from Metallica?
Well, obviously that first time in the State Theater. I know that you know, soon after that, Bobby Gustafson had gotten pretty close with James, you know, and they were back and forth. And I remember by the time we were headlining the Ritz, James was in town, came and played Fuck You with us,
nice.
You know, on stage, sang the backgrounds. So it was Gustafson, and I think they were both playing Explorers. Or maybe Bobby had the same Flying V and Explorers as James did, so it looked like James was holding his own guitar when he was up there.
Yeah, I remember the Hello from the Gutter video. One of my friends at the time asking me, like, is James Hetfield in Overkill? I'm like, no, that's a different guy with an Explorer and skin-tight jeans with holes in the knees and long blonde hair.
It was,
Yeah.
It was really a cool duality of purpose there at one point with these guys.
the toxic twins of thrash.
Oh, let me tell you something. We weren't the most open-minded people back then, you know? You know, we were like, are you sure this is cool, man?
I love it.
I was at the Ritz that same show, I remember, and I developed nodes or polyps on my vocal cords after the Field of Fire tour. I mean, we'd done Europe, and then we did Slayer while I was recording Taking Over, while the vocals were to be done. So we didn't want to miss the tour. So we did this long Slayer tour, and man, I just couldn't go back and sing that. So I had to start taking these vocal lessons, you know, and because they hadn't gotten so bad. I just strained it and they developed abrasions on the chords. So I had to learn how to sing correctly to get those abrasions off. And to me, it's real obvious between the Field of Fire record and the Taking Over record, how my voice had changed because of those lessons. Mm. And I was standing at the Ritz. I was always a little bit in the early day embarrassed of, you know, warming up in a room full of people. I didn't want, you know, everybody's drinking beer and I didn't want to do that. So I would go somewhere privately. And I found this little like utility closet off the side of stage right in the Ritz down off of the dressing room. And I was in there doing my, you know, hallelujah, you know.
Yeah.
Right, you know, where so I'm listening to the voice up, and then there's a knock on the door of the utility closet, and it's James, and he goes, Don Lawrence? I said, yep, Don Lawrence. He goes, me too. So there was a commonality from the early days.
That is awesome. Yeah, and like you said, it's something that, a little self-conscious about, because you didn't know anybody else who was doing it back then.
Oh, sure. And it's a rough and tough approach as opposed to this like operatic approach. But the operatics were the things that made the rough and tough approach possible to do night after night.
Yeah. And I would imagine, you know, as tough as it was to suffer through the polyps and stuff back then, what a gift it was to run into those troubles early enough to figure out what to do about it. Because now here you are, you know, this far into Overkill's career and your voice still sounds killer. And that's not the case for, you know, a lot of guys who, because nobody knew when this kind of music started, like, what it was going to sound like in a couple decades. You know, it's because it's so physical.
Or that it would even be here. But you're 100% right. Some guys have lost it. James is one of the ones that hasn't lost. I mean, I always appreciate what he does. And, you know, I always think of him as a front man. I've always worked on kind of being a front man, and it's always about what comes into my mind at the time. And if I like it, I repeat it the next time. So it's just kind of I compiled it over X amount of years. And I always thought to myself, boy, I'd really love to be able to control an entire crowd by just tilting my head. The fucking Hetfield can tilt his head and close one eye, and it's like, and he gets a response. I was like, that's not going to work for me.
Yeah, that's something about that sort of tribal, communal. We could name all the bands that can do that, right? You know, Maiden, you know, yeah, where there's an ocean of people in front of them, and they're all tuned in to the nuances of what one or two guys are doing. It's a powerful thing.
Yep. Awesome.
It's an insane thing. It's interesting. You were talking about the voice. You know, I saw an interview with Hetfield where he pointed out, I hadn't thought about it this way before, but when they're doing the Big Four stuff, 3 out of 4 Big Four frontmen have had neck surgery. Mustaine, Hetfield, and Tom from Slayer have all had their necks operated on at some point from relentless headbanging.
I put that together. Smoke.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way either until he pointed it out. And it's like, yeah, it makes sense, you know, when you nobody thought about in their early 20s, like, what's it going to be like doing this night after night all around the world on your body, you know?
I guess we could have called it the Broken Three plus Anthrax.
Well, and I think Anthrax slid by because they had different frontmen. So,
good point.
each guy got to take a few years off and come back. Have you experienced anything that you think was like a physical toll from the physicality of thrash metal music aside from the polyps?
No, I've always lived my life like, a teenager down the shore, you know? I mean, it's just like, I don't think about it. I don't care. I mean, occasionally I get a twist or a pain here and there, but I've always kind of taken care of myself, simultaneously. I kind of know what my limitations are, even though my limits are pretty far when it comes to, how I perform. But I've slowed down to some degree. I'm not 28 anymore. I'm 25. It's a different approach, but I think it's just adjusted, to that time passing, and again, if it works for me, I repeat it. If it hurts me, I don't repeat it.
that's like that old joke, doctor, it hurts when I do this. Don't do that.
there was a guy I really connected with, a singer from an Irish band called Gamma Bomb. We took him out on the road for a couple of tours, and Philip and I just have that. I just like his Irish sense of humor, and he's always telling jokes. And so Philip Byrne asked me about how I fronted the band and how I concocted all this shit. And I said, listen, man, I said, I didn't make any of this up. All I did was steal the good stuff from other guys. It's as simple as it is. So borrow away, my friend.
Share and share alike.
That's right. Yeah.
We tend to think about the thrash sort of architects as a community, and I know it is, but I wonder, was it competitive back in the day, especially being label mates and probably going after some of the same tours and all that sort of thing? Were you guys, watching what each other was doing, or were you kind of just focused, in your own lane the whole time?
Well, I think if you ask most people, they would say, oh no, there was no competition, but listen, the competitive edge is one of the reasons I like doing this. So I'd be an absolute liar to tell you that, I don't pay attention to other people's fortunes when we're writing music, but for right. sure, when we're performing, it's all about competition, and it's all about burying that competition. I mean, in the nicest possible way. I mean, I'm not saying I hate them. I'm saying that they inspire me to do better. And I think that that's something Overkill has always had. I don't think it's just me in this band that thinks that. When we step out there, we say this is our stage. So I do think in the early days that there was a friendly camaraderie, obviously. I remember meeting Gary Holt from Exodus for the first time and saying things like it's kind of like being long lost cousins that never met each other.
Yeah,
but at the same time, man, I didn't want him to take that show. I wanted us to take that show. So it was, let's say, a friendly competition that really, for sure, inspired me and does to this day. It's not about, oh, we're all friends, Oh, I, of course I want my friends to succeed. I just want to succeed a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, and that's how the audience gets the best show. If every band is taking the stage with that gang mentality, like they're, they want to win the night.
I remember him walking off stage in 2007 and saying he was sweating his ass off, Gary. And he walks down this ramp. I think we were in Spain, and he walks down the ramp, and we were going to go on in a half hour. And he goes, beat that. And I said, my pleasure. So I think it's with it, through the whole thing. Now, obviously there was a couple of crooked smiles flashed at each other while that was happening. It wasn't done with any animosity, but I think somewhere in there that shows you're right, that the crowd wins.
Yeah, the crowd wins, exactly. Yeah, and there was a moment recently I've seen Mustaine a couple times has complained that in the behind-the-scenes documentary from the Big Four thing, there's a moment where, Metallica's about to go on stage and they're getting their game face on, and Kirk makes a comment to the effect of, Big Four, no, it's the Big One. And it's like, I don't think you should be offended by that, because I think it's more... That's how a band should think right before you step on stage. It doesn't mean you don't love all the other bands. It just means like, okay, now we want to, it's our turn. We're going to go out and dominate. I think all four bands should have felt that way. I'm sure if there was a camera on every one of them at every minute, you would have heard something out of somebody else too that could be misconstrued. But
I'm sure in Dave's dressing room too, could be that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And no disrespect to either one of those guys. I just think it's kind of like, you got to give and take there. Like, it's as you said, it's a friendly competition, and yeah, the audience wins.
I think it's great. I think it's one of the great aspects of this music.
I got to ask you, and I kind of want to go, you know, backwards through the Metallica catalog with you a little bit. But I want to start actually with Lou Reed, only because I believe you're a fan. And, you know, Lulu, of course, has come up on the podcast before, but typically with people that weren't really fans of Lou Reed in the first place. So I'm curious when that whole thing happens, what your thoughts were on it and, you know, how it struck you.
Let's say not my favorite. You know, Lou Reed was more an introduction into rock and roll with me. Mm. I actually got into the Velvet Underground after some of his solo career stuff. He'd done a record called Heavy Metal, and one of the best live records that I think still to this day is called Rock and Roll Animal. It was he put a band together of fantastic musicians. Dick Wagner, Steve Hunter, who actually did tons of the studio work for Alice Cooper. And They did this, they open Rock and Roll Animal with this, just this kind of, introduction into a song called Sweet Jane, which is really just a big fucking five chord cruncher, the entire tune. But these guys, you know, set the tone in this for what was to follow with, you know, the way Thin Lizzy used two guitars, the way even Maiden used two guitars after, obviously, you know, with their own style. But these two, first two, Hunter and Wagner, were the two guys in Lou Reed's band that just kind of opened that whole thing. And anyone who's never heard that introduction and that first song on Rock and Roll Animal, it's really worth listening. I mean, it's just tremendous guitar work, and it's one of the reasons I was attracted to Lou Reed and actually saw him on that tour. But there was, as much as I loved Lou Reed, there was also stuff I really disliked about it. I didn't like the artistic approach as much as I liked his guttural approach to things. Mm. Like the song Rock and Roll, the song Heroin, I liked. I didn't particularly like some of the versions of Vicious by the Velvet Underground. I just didn't like the song very much, and I know it was one of their most popular songs. So when Lulu came along, obviously, I was interested.
And you mentioned Sweet Jane, and actually that was one of the songs Metallica, you know, when they backed Lou Reed at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, that was one of the songs they did together.
And a great killer version. Song. Yeah. Great version. But I didn't like the record that much. Whatever the idea was behind it, never got into me. It just didn't make it. Yeah,
I've said this on the podcast several times before, so I'll try to spare my listeners hearing it again. But in short, like, I totally respect, understand, and appreciate why they did it when the opportunity arose. I just think that once it was finished, it's the kind of thing that you put on a shelf somewhere, and maybe someday, years from now, you know, when the band's not in a position to tour anymore or something, it becomes one of those legacy releases that's like, oh, did you know? Once upon a time, Metallica did this whole weird record with Lou Reed. But, you know, to give it kind of the full court press as like a official release was really just asking for it.
Yeah, on paper, you know, I look at it on paper and I say, how fucking great is that? You know, but there's a lot of things on paper that, you know, that they just don't come to fruition when you put it into practice. You know, that's kind of the way I looked at it. It almost comes across to me as the anti-Metallica record.
You know, it's the only one, even including Saint Anger, that I've never been able to get through in one continuous listen. And I'm a super fan, obviously. But I also appreciate the, I feel like somewhere in there, maybe Lars in particular, knows that it's terrible and sort of wanted to inflict it on us as its own artistic statement. Like, try to get through this, you know? I respect the punk rockness of that.
It's, you know. They got to dislike something we do. Exactly. I mean, there was a point there. I mean, they could have farted for fucking 60 minutes and still the record would have went to number one. I mean, it was just... That was insane. What a role they were on.
Maybe that was their attempt at disproving that. I'm with you. It's like it's a cool idea on paper, but not so much. But yeah, a lot of the covers and different things that they've tried, you know, we're talking about the Ramones. Somewhere in that Saint Anger era, they recorded like 6 or 7 Ramones covers. There's a bunch of them out there. I think they came out as Japanese B-sides. And there was a weird moment where they played a couple of shows with Bob Rock on bass, and they did a bunch of those Ramones songs. Did you ever hear those or check those out at all?
Primarily on the internet, the revisited recordings. It's not something that I keep around. I mean, I like the way they do punk stuff because they do it like thrash songs.
Yeah.
So I always think that that's really cool, that approach to it. I mean, you probably know from us, we've always had that punk element in us. Released something called Welcome to the Garden State on Wings of War. And you know, I was doing all these interviews for it. And I mean, this, you could probably translate this over to the whole Metallica approach. And you know, the question would be, you know, that has got to be the punkiest song you ever did. I said, for sure it's punk influence, but I said, it is just played too fucking well to be a punk song. And I'm not fooling myself. I'm just saying it's a thrash song because it's played with superior musicianship. You know, if you start that song with Jason Bittner playing a punk beat and then finish it off with me dropping the vocals on after everybody builds it, you have yourself, you know, one fucking solid, valuable piece of real estate. It's not some attitude approach to it. It is just about sonically perfect when it comes to it. And that's one of the things that I liked, how Metallica could, you know, how they could present something that was so attitude, laced, so imperfect, and then turn it into something that was perfect. And that's what made the song different than the original, which is what I appreciated in those Ramones covers.
Yeah, you know, on a related note, I think that's what I love about their Merciful Fate medley. And obviously Merciful Fate has its own charms and oddities and, you know, spookiness about it. And I like that Metallica took, you know, obviously Hetfield wasn't going to do the King Diamond falsetto, so that he sort of figured out his own approach to those vocals. And yeah, it's like a sort of streamlined, perfected version of something that's really cool on its own because it's so weird and off-kilter that they're able to then take the spare parts of it and refine it. And yeah, I think that, you probably just explained what thrash is in general. Like, it took, you know, kind of the slickness of heavy metal with the attitude and aggression of punk, and now we have thrash.
And if you can get sonic perfection out of it and still keep an attitude, fantastic. I mean, I'll tell you though, there's nothing I dislike more than somebody doing a cover that sounds like the original. You know, it's
right. What's the point?
To me, it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, add your own, you know, add your own spices to it. You know, put your personality on it, your stamp. You know, I think that we're lucky that in this band that when we do covers, probably very much like Metallica, there are distinguishable voices presenting those lyrics or those melody lines.
Yeah.
So it immediately becomes different. That's the key. Now and now also the tonalities that both bands are going to use. I mean, that's really the key to that. But keeping that energy or upping that energy is where the X factor in the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's where songs even really, you know, end up becoming a band's own. You know, when you obviously, you know, Subhumans, Fuck You is an overkill song to many people. And just like Am I Evil and Metallica and, you know, Got the Time and Antisocial with Anthrax. And, you know, that speaks to, like you said, putting your own unique voice and, you know, putting it through your prism rather than just trying to do a note for note redo.
You know, I was just having this conversation with a guy about the 80s bands, you know, that came out and the ones that still exist, you know, whether it be Exodus or Testament and Anthrax and, you know, all of them, the big four. The one thing that was different about that approach to metal than what has followed it was that each band had an individualist as a singer. Every one of them could be recognized by the voice. If you didn't recognize the production, you would know who it was when the voice came in. I think in the modern era, and it's not all, obviously, but in the modern era of nu metal. I think post Phil Anselmo's Pantera, you get a very similar approach to things. Unless you are like the fan of that band or totally aware of that band, it could be in some cases half a dozen different bands where the distinguishable element kind of goes away. And I think it's something that this genre has as kind of the last cowboys, is that individualism with regard to approach of the vocals.
Yeah, where it's not so much about the nuance of the different tones and things to identify it as it is the person's voice. Oh, that's so-and-so singing.
Tonality. That's Anthrax. You know Joey's voice as soon as he opens his mouth. You know, I mean, I know Anthrax by a riff, and I think the way Charlie plays, but I think if you were a casual fan, you would know that's not Metallica or that's not Megadeth. That is Anthrax.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't really thought about it that way, because there is sort of a uniformity of vocal style that has dominated metal in recent years. And yeah, that there's for sure something to be said for that identity, which I think of the thrash movement, when it comes to identifiable voices, I mean, you would definitely be in a top four, in terms of like, oh, that's Blitz, no one who is a fan of this music won't recognize, your voice right at the top of a song. That's for damn sure.
We call it, when we're recording, we call it Mickey Mouse on meth.
Perfect. Mickey Mouse on meth. Copyright Disney. don't get sued. Mickey Meth, maybe, is a somebody's got to draw that character for you.
we got to make a T-shirt.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's an overkill T-shirt. The Blitz is Mickey Meth. on the Metallica front, we all sort of love the classics, and of course, everyone loves Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets. And are there any sort of deep cuts or album tracks that have been favorites of yours over the years that maybe wouldn't be so obvious?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I think I have to say I'm obviously aware of all that they've done, but not at the high level I was up until, let's say, the Black Album. I started going to going different ways, at that point. I liked their live stuff too. I do like Binge and Purge.
Yeah.
I think that's because that to me, I mean, that's the purity of what this is all about. I think that this is obviously a pre Pro Tools genre. We've all adapted to it as time goes on, and it's obviously made this easier. And it's technology is a great thing, but when I think of when I started listening less or becoming less connected, it's probably around the same time that technology changed, that my favorite records were done on 2-inch tapes or recorded live on DAT tapes, which I, so for me to hear, stuff on that live record, I think that it's real special because that's the way the songs were created originally. And to go to Binge and Purge and hear Whiplash, for instance, is a little bit more special to me than hearing it on the first record.
Yeah, I totally hear that. And especially that something about that attack and that aggression that comes out in those live versions, especially when a band is at its peak and, in the midst of a 200-date world tour. And then to capture that and put it in a bottle is super exciting.
And that's the purity of the whole thing. I mean, sure, making a record is a great thing. I mean, and people liken it to art. I kind of liken it to, being a craftsman more than being an artist by just getting better at your craft. But I think that the purity, what I mean, is that those songs were created, in the room somewhere. Maybe one guy coming up with that riff and then bringing it to the other guy who put the drum tracks to it, and then Kirk coming in with, with a lead. So it was assembled, and it was done. From my experience, you fucking know it. You're like, you're there, you're going, oh my God, it's fucking done. We may not be playing it perfectly right at this point, but this is the purest that this song is ever going to be. Now, to go on later on, so many years later, and capture that purity again in a live setting, I think is one of the greatest accomplishments you can do. I mean, we just recently, the last couple of years, we did a thing called Live at Oberhausen in Germany, and we recorded Feel the Fire from start to finish. So the key here is not to, let's not fuck up. It's like, let's not think about it. Because if we start thinking about it, we're going to lose what the charm of the song was in its purest sense when it first meant something to us. And I think that's how we succeeded with that record, not over practiced or worried about fucking up parts.
Oh God. Amen to that. You guys were putting out killer live stuff even back in the day. I know I told you this story before, but my Fuck You EP had the cassette had the reversible cover where the record store could hide the middle finger. And yeah, I mean, that was perfect. That was the best way as a kid in high school to get away with that tape with my dad.
and then slide it between the mattresses. Right. Yeah. You're welcome. I'll tell you, we had this great back in 87. I was living in a different part of Jersey, and, I was down by, where the old Bridge Metal Militia was, in that area, and hanging out with these guys. And I mean, shit, I was putting in ceiling fans during the week to make a few bucks, but I was already, touring with Overkill. And I was approached by a high school art teacher who asked if he could do rims at the time.
Yeah.
You know, it made the stage look bigger. And he was going to let his art class do it for us. So just give him the dimensions, the cloth, and he'll supply, the paint. He wants to do it. And I said, hey, this is great, but we have scrims ready. Well, we could do secondary scrims for you. And I said, well, the only ones we need are for the song Fuck You. He's like, I'd love it. So <that's> it's this 10th grade art class. Go to school every day. The parents think they're becoming artists.
They're painting middle fingers.
Middle fingers. These two big scrims that we used for years.
That's so great. That's the teacher of the year right there too. Kudos.
Yeah, he is, man. That's an open-minded cat.
And I mean, you know what? It is art, and that their art was then traveled all around the world with you. So it's
sure. And hey, listen, art is not about being safe. It's about it's about taking a chance somewhere. And I think that this guy proved that to those kids.
Hell yeah. Well, why I've got you, I want to just say, this run that Overkill has been on, I would say, as a fan, I would start it with Electric Age, and that going into White Devil and Grinding Wheel and then this new record. I mean, it's just, for journalists to want to tell a story of like, Overkill is really just on a roll. It's like, well, I mean, it's record after record after record now. Like, what do you attribute that to? Sort of this creative streak of just putting out some of your best records, at this stage in your career. I mean, is it about just kind of refining what you do or not fucking too much with the recipe? Or, what do you attribute that to how the material has continued to just be consistently this good?
Well, I mean, I get it too. I feel it from the inside. I think the key for us is not overthinking it. I mean, we're not a band that over talks. Some people can fuck up a free lunch. You know what I mean? By over talking. We're not this huge communicative band. We're more about enjoying the time that we have together, and then good results come out of it. And I think that because we're fucking old, we don't give a shit.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Bobby the Blitz Ellsworth. You can keep up with me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. And be sure to follow Speak and Destroy on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And check things out at speakanddestroy.com. Be sure to download and listen to previous Speak and Destroy episodes with great guests like M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, Rob Flynn of Machine Head, David Ellefson of Megadeth, Lizzie Hale of Hailstorm, Derek Wibley from Sum 41, and many, many more. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.